Hello, and you are very welcome to Season 2 of Waterways Through Time with me, Turtle Bunbury. We have some lovely episodes lined up for you, a mix of interviews with people who are working or otherwise associated with the waterways of Ireland, while there is also plenty about the history, the rich history of our waters. We're going to carry forward from where we left off in Season 1 and bring us on through the centuries with the look at the Vikings and the Normans and an astonishingly active O'Connor King who was reconstructing parts of the Shannon long centuries ago. So I hope you enjoy the episodes, enjoy the season, and without further ado, let us commence. In earlier episodes of this series, we have looked at the geology, the archaeology, the early folklore around our rivers and lakes. We've also touched upon the monastic influence, the island monasteries and the great Christian schools of Ireland's golden age. In this episode, we're going to home in on a people who very much like the sound of a country enjoying a golden age, namely the Vikings. In earlier episodes of this series, we talked about how rivers and lakes were the way that people got around. Now, bear in mind that the rivers of Ireland, and in fact most rivers in Europe, were much swampier and broader and a lot less navigable than they are now, before humans beat them into shape with navvies and dredgers and so on, and we'll come on to that in due course. It is precisely because the rivers were the highways, the main transport network, that the people of Ireland chose to build their communities and homes and villages and whatnot along or close to those waterways. We've already talked about all those monastic schools and hermitages along the rivers and lakes, the 12 island monasteries on Loch Earn, for instance, and all those other ones on Loch Ree and Loch Derg. The point is that those locations might seem utterly remote to us today, but 1,000 years ago, an island monastery was like a ringside seat on the great watery highway. You're right beside the island's main transport system. That works very well if you're trying to shift things around, passengers perhaps, monastic students, or animals and food supplies for the coming winter. But what happens when a darker force gains access to those waterways? A force whose sole game plan seems to be to raid and plunder and generally go on the rampage. I am talking, of course, about the Vikings. The Vikings would be one of the most powerful influences on Irish life for the bones of 400 years. I mean, they first show up in the late 8th century, and there's still going to be Viking kings in Ireland when the Normans arrive almost 400 years later. 400 years, that's a long time. That's like us going back in time to the 1620s. And, well, look at how much has happened since the 1620s. So I want to delve into the Vikings and their impact on the waterways. The chances are that you have got some Viking DNA circulating in your bloodstream. There's Viking names all around us. Reynolds, Higgins, O'Loughlin, McAuliffe, Rourke, Dowdle. Because over those 400 years, there was a lot of intermarriage. And the Irish kind of took up the Viking way of life. So, well, it's complicated. But the bottom line is that DNA suggests the Irish have way more Viking blood than was previously thought. Most of the Vikings who came to Ireland were from the north and west coasts of Norway. Some were from Denmark, a few from Sweden, but they were mainly from Norway. And these Norse or Norwegian warriors seem to have had brown hair rather than the blonde hair we generally associate with Vikings. In fact, they didn't call themselves Vikings and they didn't wear horny hats either, but look, let's not spoil the story too much. I'm going to call them Vikings because that's a term we all relate to. That's why the hit TV series is simply called Vikings. Most of it was filmed, incidentally, in County Wicklow, which means Meadow of the Vikings in Viking lingo. And you know, They managed to squeeze 89 episodes out of Vikings, 6 seasons all told. And it's not all told, because they're now filming season 3 of its sequel, Vikings Valhalla. So clearly there's an immense demand for Vikings on screen, and clearly we buy into the word Viking. Whether they were driven by volcanic climate change, or their thirst for adventure, or the need to acquire land in other places, whatever it was, these fearless warriors would control, or certainly be a major player on the Irish seas throughout most of the 9th, 10th, 11th centuries, all the seas around us, all around Ireland, around Britain, or much of it, and all the way up the Isle of Man, the northwest coast of Scotland, up to the Orkneys and the Shetlands, right up to Iceland, and well, in due course, the Vikings would make an impression in places as far away as Morocco and Istanbul and Russia and Ukraine and even into North America. That is a very big watery highway. But now, let us, like them, home in on Ireland, which is, as we've discussed, a land celebrated for its Christianity, with its monastic schools where the European royals were sending their children to be educated, sanctuaries of peace and contemplation. But word is out that they are also sanctuaries of immense wealth. Some of it is agricultural wealth, the fruit of its well-run farms, but there's also a lot of religious bling, chalices and bejeweled crosses and processional crosses and tapestries and so on. Now, you might think that such wealth would invite the local clans to attack, and sometimes they did, but mostly they didn't, because the Irish were now, by and large, a Christian people. A few centuries earlier, they were more like the Vikings and believed in a whole pantheon of different gods. But now that they're Christians, they're kind of a little bit terrified that their souls might burn in purgatory forevermore if they, say, break into an abbey and rob a golden chalice. But what if you didn't believe in purgatory or Christian gods? What if you were a Viking with a boat and a compass, and someone tells you about these places, these sprawling, undefended communities that are stuffed with golden chalices and barns full of food? The Viking raids kicked off in the 790s. There may have been earlier ones, but this is when they kind of crank it up, and the big date given is 793. That's when they attack the island monastery of Lindisfarne off the coast of England. They killed nearly everyone there, took the survivors off as slaves. When you read the reaction to Lindisfarne, it's like the White Walkers have arrived, if you know your Game of Thrones, or the fungus zombies from The Last of Us. As one Anglo-Saxon scholar wrote, "Never before has such terror appeared as we have now suffered." And soon enough, these terror-inducing pirates are heading for Ireland. They start with the outlying islands, Rathlin, Lambay, Inishmurray, Inishboffin, right down the west coast to the Skelligs. It's kind of straight up hit and run attacks, kill the monks, steal the goods, skedaddle. The same thing's happening along the coast of Scotland. Iona, the monastic retreat founded by St. Columba long centuries earlier, that's hit again and again until 806 AD, when 68 members of the Iona community were slaughtered. Iona, of course, is where they created the magnificent Book of Kells, and that book has had a truly epic life, as the monks only got it out of there in the nick of time before the Vikings attack, and they somehow sailed it across the sea to Ireland and got it to Kells Abbey on the Blackwater in County Meath. The Blackwater is a tributary of the River Boyne. Now, the monks presumably stuck the Book of Kells in Kells because they figured the Vikings would never dare come up the river, would they? Would they? Well, yes, they would. In fact, what you see by the year 840 is a change in strategy by the Vikings. Before that, they do those annual hit-and-run attacks, and then they beat it back to the fjords of Norway or Denmark or wherever they came from. But starting in about 840, they change tack. They decide to stay around, to spend the winter in Ireland, to plan a new spring campaign. Why waste time paddling back to the fjords? Let's stick up a few wattle cottages and make a base here in Ireland. And so they start building these long ports, these defended, sheltered harbours or ship camps. And in time, these are going to spring up at the mouths of pretty much every river in Ireland. Not only that, but these Viking winter camps are going to one day become our biggest cities. Dublin, Waterford, Cork, Limerick, Drogheda. They all start as Viking camps. And eventually, as I say, you have this chain of Viking forts controlling the entrances to all those rivers and blocking the exit. And, well, they start to use those rivers to go have a little plunder fun when the fancy takes them. The Shannon, the Erne, the Barrow, the Ban, these are their new playgrounds. Now, the big figure in this tale is a guy called Thorgesius, or at least I'm going to call him Thorgesius. You will see his name written in a bunch of different ways. He's Tergesius, he's Turgis, he's Thorgest, he's Thorgil. But I think there's a nice touch of Thor in Thorgesius. He is a Viking warlord, probably Norse, but, you know, we need to take note. We are kind of on the cusp of mythology and fact here in terms of what we know. What we know, or think we know, is that he first appeared on the Irish waters in about 820. I suspect he was with the Vikings who appeared in Belfast Lough in 823 AD and killed the Bishop of Bangor. And maybe he was also on the River Erne, because in 822, the Vikings made their way up the Erne and burned the monastery on Devonish Island. Maybe he goes away for a while, maybe he stays around, who knows? I feel that he's the sort of guy who would have orchestrated the attacks in the big bad year of 836 AD, when, as the annals of Ulster record, all the churches of Lough Erne, together with Cluanish and Dunish, that's Clonus and Devonish Island, were destroyed by the Gentiles. Clonus. Now, Vikings are sea pirates, but Clonus is a long way from the sea. They probably ventured into the Lough Head near Lisnaskee on Lough Erne. They also appear to have been on the Colebrook River, which connects Lough Head to the Erne. So they're in all those places. All the churches of Lough Erne destroyed. Well, I mean, you know, no surprise that the monasteries were on the hit list. Now, traditionally, the image is of total destruction. But some say it wasn't quite as hardcore as that, because the Viking leaders weren't stupid and they realised these monasteries could be the golden geese that kept on laying. So maybe it was better to raid them, yes, but then let them flourish once more, maybe for a few years, and then attack again. And I guess there may be something in that theory. I mean, we know they wanted plunder. Books, not so much, but precious stones and metalwork and gold, yes. And food, yes. Bear in mind that there would have been substantial stores of provisions in monastic communities, which is just what you need if you've got a few thousand warriors looking for some food for the long winter. The Vikings also liked people. By that I mean they liked to enslave people and sell them on. On the Vikings' watch, Dublin would become one of the great slave centres of Western Europe. And who started that? Well, we're back to our friend Thorgesius, apparently. He's credited with founding the city of Dublin in 841, built a fort on a hill right where Dublin Castle is today. It had a harbour beside it where they could fit 200 ships, and this was a trading centre for the Gulgoidal, that's a sort of Norse-Irish mixed community. The monks called it Dublin, the Black Pool, and the Vikings ran with the name. Dublin it is. Now, I don't know if Thorgesius was really the guy who started Dublin, but he was certainly knocking around this time. The annals say he had a fleet of 120 ships by 837. That's a massive fleet. I don't know if they were all longships, but if they were, an average longship was capable of carrying between 25 and 60 people, so we could be talking of several thousand Vikings on board as a minimum, and maybe there was more, feasibly a lot more. Either way, that's a whole lot of Viking. Tergesius splits his fleet. He has half of those guys on the River Boyne, so good luck to the monks trying to hide the Book of Kells, and he has the other half, the other 60 ships, on the Liffey. Now, when all is said and done, he still has several thousand warriors beating their chests looking for plunder, so he's got to go somewhere. He could go east, of course, harass the coast of Wales, or the Isle of Man, maybe. Or he can do a little inland tourism in Ireland, and that's what he chooses to do. By 839, the Vikings have sailed up the Bann into Lough Neagh, from where they plunder most of the churches in that whole area for the next few years. Thorgesius himself heads for Lough Derg and the Shannon. In 836, they burn Inishcaltra Monastery to the ground, and then they advance up river. And imagine how terrifying it would have been if you were a monk or a nun or a farm boy living on the edge of the Shannon when word reaches you that Thorgesius's fleet is on the way, destroying, it is said, all that is in its path. Thorgesius took a shine to Lough Ree, and why wouldn't you? What a lovely loch it is. He is said to have established his base on the Rindoon Peninsula. I believe Hare Island at the bottom of Lough Ree was the site of another Viking encampment. And from Lough Ree, the Vikings then attack all the places within range. The monastic schools at Clonfert and Clonmacnoise, the monasteries of Laura and Terryglass, and everything in between, leading one contemporary chronicler to write, "Increasingly from hundreds of monasteries rose to heaven the mournful litany, A furore Northmanorum libera nos domini. From the fury of the Northmen, save us, O Lord." I mentioned Clonmacnoise. Thorgesius is a return customer to Clonmacnoise. Some say he actually had a fortress of some form there. Legends claim that he declared himself abbot of Armagh, and that he and his wife Ota, she's described as a vulva, that's like a seeress or a sorceress, depends who you read, but some say Ota and Thorgesius went into Clonmacnoise and recited pagan chants from the ruined high altar. Others say they danced naked and engaged in lewd acts. I can't tell you what the truth is, because luckily I wasn't there. Thorgesius finally headed to Valhalla in 845 AD. He was killed. His killer is said to have been Malachy, the king of Meath. And the story is that Malachy sent the Viking warlord a gift of his own beautiful daughter accompanied by 14 comely maidens. And so smitten was Thorgesius that he failed to realise that the 14 comely maidens were assassins in disguise. And these assassins then tied him up in chains, placed him in a barrel, and rolled him into Loch Owl near Mullingar, where the tyrant drowned in good riddance to him. His death must have been a very welcome moment on the Shannon, and there's definitely an easing of Viking activity in the region for a long time afterwards. That era of attacks had been a dark one for the monasteries especially. It was a huge challenge to the whole monastic education system and culture and so on. That said, let's look for the positives, because the Vikings may have been responsible for the introduction of saunas to Ireland. It is said that Vikings, Danish Vikings actually, raiding up the Shannon introduced the custom of saunas or sweat houses. They were, of course, known in Finland at this time. I don't know, but if anyone knows more of Shannon side saunas in the Viking Age, I'm all ears. But what is clear is that the Vikings were zooming in on every river in Ireland. You see it clearly on the Barrow. In 824, a fleet of Vikings sailed up from Waterford to St. Mullins. And I've read that there was a big battle at St. Mullins in 888, which the Vikings lost, and after which 200 heads were left behind. So that sounds like a bit of a grim day. They had a long fort, one of those harbours. It was a sort of oval fort at Dunralley near Vicarstown, County Leash, that was enclosed by the Barrow and a tributary called the Glashna River. And that again provided safe anchorage for Viking ships in the region. Now, the death of Thorgesius was a blow, but things also went downhill for the Vikings when they were kicked out of Dublin in 902, and kicked out with such force that they actually moved to northern Britain and the Isle of Man and France and faraway places. But these warriors, they wander for a while and then they regroup and then they come back, and this time they head for Munster. 12 years later, 12 years after Dublin fell, 914 AD, a mighty Scandinavian fleet arrives from northern France, apparently, into Waterford. And here's how their arrival was described in a contemporary manuscript called The War of the Irish with the Foreigners. And it's going to start off talking about a guy called Earl Otter Dove, Black Otter. He seems to have been the sort of leader at the start. Anyway, the Earl Otter came with 100 ships to Waterford, and the east of Munster was plundered by him. The whole of Munster became filled with immense floods and countless sea vomitings of ships and boats and fleets. Yes, it does say vomitings of ships and boats and fleets. So that there was not a harbour, nor a landing port, nor a dun, nor a fortress, nor a fastness in all Munster without fleets of Danes and pirates. And then he continues. There came also the fleet of Oibird, and the fleet of Oduin, and the fleet of Griffin, and the fleet of Snoutgower, and the fleet of Lagman, and the fleet of Errolf, and the fleet of Sitrick. And he literally goes on. He names 9 more fleets, 16 in total, that arrived into Ireland at this time. And he concludes, and assuredly the evil which Erin, that's Ireland, assuredly the evil which Erin had hitherto suffered was as nothing compared to the evil inflicted by these parties. Oh, and the last of those fleets, the last of the 16, it's the fleet of the Ingenrua, the red-haired maiden known as the Red Girl. So you literally have a red-haired shield maiden leading her fleet of longships onto Irish shores. These guys were not here to go trout fishing. Munster was devastated in 914-915 AD. 2 years later, 917, the Vikings win a big battle. They annihilate the Irish. They leave 600 men dead, including the King of Leinster. That battle is said to have been fought in the Valley of Glynn on the River Barrow, just outside St. Mullins again. From here, these same Vikings roll on up through Kildare and they retake Dublin and they kill the High King. That is like winning the Grand Slam. And it's at this time that the Vikings found a bunch of Ireland's port cities, particularly along the south coast. Cork, Waterford, Limerick, Wexford, they're all founded about this time, 921, 922 AD, or maybe there was something smaller there before, but at this time, you know, they really start developing those long forts into proper community hubs. In the 920s and 930s, there's a guy from, a warlord from Limerick, he's called Olaf, and he sets off from there into up the Shannon, and he controls Loch Ree for the bones of 20 years before he is finally sent packing. And shifting back to Loch Earn, the annals for 923, so exactly the same time frame as the above, they note a fleet of foreigners on Loch Earn, and they plundered the islands of the lake and the territories round it to and fro. So they're everywhere, all at once, all over again. But actually, from here on, until the arrival of the Normans, really, you do see a bit of a shift as the Vikings evolve from plunderers into, well, into settlers. They become farmers and traders, and they establish colonies and towns and so on, and they even give up on their old gods and start converting to Christianity. And meanwhile, they're also getting sucked into that never-ending Game of Thrones in pre-Norman Ireland with all those wars between the kings and the mini-kings and all the various factions. The biggest king of them all, of course, is top-ranking Viking basher Brian Boru of the Dalcash dynasty in County Clare, well, Limerick and Clare. You might know his hometown, Killaloe, in County Clare. It lies on the River Shannon on the western bank of Loch Derg. Now, when Brian was a reasonably young fella, there was a guy called King Ivar. He was king of the short-lived Norse kingdom of Limerick. And King Ivar made the mistake of burning some of Brian's churches down, and Brian didn't like that. And so King Ivar of the short-lived Norse kingdom of Limerick was driven out of his base at King's Island on the Shannon in central Limerick. It was right where St. John's Castle is now. That's where the Vikings were based. He shifts off. He creates a new Viking stronghold on Scattery Island at the mouth of the Shannon, which is still a useful spot as the island kind of controlled all the maritime traffic going up and down the Shannon. Incidentally, I believe that Bunratty Castle stands on the site of a Viking camp from this very time also. Now, the story runs that King Ivar and his two sons, whose names translate as Wild Dog and Darkhead, they wouldn't sound out of place in an Electric Picnic lineup, really. Anyway, these three fellas, Ivar, Wild Dog and Darkhead, they were ambushed and killed by Brian Boru in 977. And thus, Ivar was the last Norse king of Limerick, while Brian Boru would, of course, go on to trounce the Vikings at the Battle of Clontarf. Only it's a whole lot more complicated than that, because the Vikings were kind of Irish and the Irish were kind of Vikings, and nobody's quite sure what really happened anyway. I should mention that there was a major showdown, or near showdown, on Loch Ree in 997 between Brian Boru and the High King Malshochnal. Brian Boru apparently fielded 300 ships, which is quite some force, but for once, diplomacy prevailed. They talked it out and nobody got hurt. Hurrah! Actually, the Vikings were getting a bit bored of Ireland by now. They kept getting beaten and losing their cities, and it was, you know, quite a lot of effort. The Irish kind of had the upper hand, and if you throw in a huge blast of radiation from the sun that hit Earth in 992 AD, and you start to see the Vikings heading further afield. They're going to end up in Iceland and Greenland and Newfoundland, and they're going to bring their Irish wives and daughters and concubines and slaves with them. There is heaps of Irish DNA going on in Iceland, for instance, but that's another story. And as I say, many more Vikings opted to stay in Ireland, and their legacy is all around us. That is why we here in Ireland celebrate the gods Odin and Thor and Frigga every single week. What's that you say? I don't celebrate Viking gods. Well, I think you do. We have Odin's Day every Wednesday, Thor's Day, Frigga's Day, Friday. They haven't gone away, you know. Anyway, while some Vikings were about to leave Ireland for Iceland and so on, a new group of Vikings, or Northmen, were sharpening their swords and preparing to head to Ireland. They're the Northmen who conquered England in a single battle in 1066, the Battle of Hastings. We know these Northmen as the Normans, and we'll come to them in due course. Thank you for tuning into this episode of Waterways Through Time. You'll find more episodes on waterwaysireland.org or on Alexa, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll find my archive of historical stories, mostly Irish, at turtlebunbury.com. My sincere thanks to series producer Ali Bunbury and technical producer Mary Burke.